The mid-20th century was a time of great clashes and contentions over the Colorado River. The competition for water between California and Arizona was fierce, so fierce that it became the greatest water war that the arid West has ever known. I came to understand something of the intricate balance between water and electricity in the West. Indeed, the presence of water in desert country inevitably leads to urban growth, and modern cities require electricity. Many of the dams constructed throughout the Colorado River system generate hydroelectricity to supply power to irrigation projects as well as communities and cities throughout the West. The truth is that the 25 million of us who live in and around the Colorado River watershed are each connected by the water that the river yields as well as the electricity that it generates. The water of the Colorado River helped jumpstart the behemoth of California, which is now one of the 10 greatest economies in the world. Over the last year, I've been fortunate to talk with people who shaped the flow of Colorado River history during the mid-20th century and who can look back and reflect on their decisions. I've spoken with others who have devoted their lives to understanding and documenting the politics, philosophies, and evolving technologies that have resulted in replumbing the flow of the river. I'm Jack Leffler, and I invite you to join me as we explore moving waters, the Colorado River, and the West. Stuart Udall is regarded by many as one of America's greatest Secretaries of the Interior. He was born in Arizona in 1920 and was elected to the United States Congress in 1952. In 1961, John F. Kennedy appointed him as Secretary of the Interior, where he remained for 8 crucial years. Stuart once told me that originally he was of the Teddy Roosevelt School of Conservation. His thinking evolved during the interior years as he was forced to balance his natural environmental inclinations with his allegiance to his home state of Arizona, all within the extremely complex political purview that surrounded the apportionment of the Colorado River. We're fortunate to hear his recollections and reflections.
Well, I was on a hot seat with regard to the Colorado River project, which was really Arizona project, which after the Supreme Court acted in 1963, Arizona then was going to have a shot to get its big project. You have to historically look at the biggest water fight in the West between big California and little Arizona. Neither of these states contributed a great deal of water to the river. The main contribution from Arizona was the Gila River, which originates in the mountains in Arizona and New Mexico. Arizona, although they walked away from Santa Fe, they didn't agree. They were given a pretty good allocation of water. But afterwards, when you got to the 1940s, California already had its aqueduct on the river, and Hoover Dam had been built, and Arizona wasn't getting much benefit. So Arizona wanted to have its big project, and they had the Bureau of Reclamation study various alternatives, what should be done. When they brought that to the floor of Congress in 1951 and 52, Senator Carl Hayden was a very powerful figure on the Appropriations Committee. Arizona then had for 2 years the Senate Majority Leader. They passed it right through the Senate and just whipped it through. California blocked it. That was their strategy. The longer they could keep Arizona off the river, the longer they could use water they weren't entitled to, you see. And that was what created a lot of enmity and a lot of suspicion in Arizona. And California blocked the legislation in the House. California was throwing its weight around and said, no, Arizona's water internally hadn't been qualified, and there were disputes with California. They had to go to the Supreme Court. Well, that was a nice strategy because it bought 11 years of delay. And that was finally resolved by the Supreme Court, confirming Arizona's contention in 1963. And then Arizona's project could then start to move forward.
In the lower basin, Arizona's annual allocation is 2.8 million acre-feet of water. Nevada's is a modest 300,000 acre-feet, and California is entitled to 4.4 million acre-feet. In Santa Barbara, I had a conversation with Colorado River scholar Norris Hundley, who was acutely aware of the fine points that shaped the development of the Colorado River.
An important thing to remember in connection with this 4.4 minimum is that California can't be deprived of that 4.4 million. It could be deprived if the river drops down to the point where there's not anything more than 4 point in the basin, then it's only going to get 4, but Nevada has to get its share. As a practical matter, California can't be deprived of the 4.4, and what makes it practically impossible is that Arizona has bound itself never to deprive California of that 4.4, even if it can't get its 2.8 million. It has obligated itself to make sure California gets 4.4, even if it means Arizona cannot get 2.8. Why? That's the price Arizona paid to get the Central Arizona Project, which was approved in 1968. California controlled enough votes that Arizona would never get the Central Arizona Project approved unless Arizona cut a deal. And the deal was that Arizona had to obligate itself to serve as insurance for California's 4.4.
Charles Wilkinson is an attorney on the faculty of the University of Colorado in Boulder. He is also the author of the excellent book Fire on the Plateau. I met with Charles in Boulder, where he revealed his passionate interest in the history of the intense conflict between California and Arizona over Colorado River water.
The competition really started in the 19th century. When Arizona became a state in 1912, it knew that it had a fast-growing competitor to the west in the form of California. And it also feared the other five states in the watershed. Early on, Arizona decided, not wanting any limits, to just use every last drop of its Colorado River water, and they were afraid and they had reasonable fears because of the system that if they didn't use it, someone else would. And so you have a really good mixture of paranoia, avarice, waste, technology, because a lot of the development was done with very high levels of technology, very admirable degree of technology, and certainly lack of concern for a river as a river. Arizona and California fighting over the Colorado River were in court 5 times, in the Supreme Court of the United States 5 times. And finally, Arizona got its water right established to the Colorado River in the famous 1963 decision. Arizona wanted to put that water to use as quickly as it could. It was very well positioned. It had Carl Hayden in the Senate, the most senior member of the Senate. He'd been serving since statehood. It had the Secretary of the Interior, who under law has very broad authority over Colorado River water.
Again, Stuart Udall.
After the war, after World War II, California had its big project, Hoover Dam. The Upper Basin states, as they were called, decided they wanted to begin dams, irrigation projects, hydroelectric dams primarily, to provide benefits and uses of water. They would tell the Bureau of Reclamation, go study where hydro dams should be built. Go study and tell us how to control the river so we can keep some of the water in our states. I'm talking about the northern states, the upper basin states. And the Bureau of Reclamation would do this, and they put together what was called the Upper Colorado Storage Project. It had a dam in Echo Park that would encroach on a national monument, and that immediately stirred a controversy. And that's where the Sierra Club took off and became a national organization under David Brower's leadership.
David Brower had a lot of help from Martin Litton, who is an environmentalist who loves the wild country and the wild rivers of the West. He was also a journalist and photographer who worked for the Los Angeles Times. I visited with Martin at his home in California, where he told me about how he and David Brower came to join forces in the mid-20th century.
I got a call from David Brower, whom I didn't know, but I think I had heard of him. It was 1952. That's when he became executive director of the Sierra Club. Well, he called me because he'd seen these articles in the Times that I'd been running, which were pretty rabid. They were pro-natural environment and nothing else. He wanted me to come and join him in doing great things with the Sierra Club. He was on fire, and we tended to get together and work together on this within the Sierra Club. And in stopping the Split Mountain and Echo Park dams in Dinosaur National Monument, the Sierra Club achieved its first real conservation victory in post-war years. We sit back, and I'm very much a part of it by then, and say, my God, how did that happen? We saved dinosaur. And saving dinosaur, you're not just talking about a quarry with dinosaur bones in it. You're talking about a vast, magnificent area that's worthy of any kind of attention, as any other national park is. There was a symbolism to it.
Floyd Dominey was commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation in the mid-20th century. He was born in 1913 and grew up on a dry farm in Nebraska. He was relentless in his pursuit of greening up the landscape of the arid West by building dams to provide water for countless irrigation projects and to generate hydroelectricity for both pumping water and to power the cities of the West.
A lot of people get confused. They think that Echo Park was a substitute for Glen Canyon or that Glen Canyon was a substitute for Echo Park. Actually, Glen Canyon Dam would have been needed whether or not Echo Park and Split Mountain were authorized. They were really strictly cash register dams. They were on the Green River. They didn't provide the huge carryover storage that was required that Glen Canyon would do. I always said that it was just a matter of poor nomenclature that they got defeated. If they'd have been called Rattlesnake Butte and Snake Hollow, we could have got them authorized. But to talk about Echo Park and Split Mountain, that was a bad nomenclature. At any rate, Dave Brower and company whipped the Bureau hands down on that one.
Again, Martin Litton.
You win something, you tend to sit back on your hands, relax, and congratulate yourself. But meanwhile, the whole Colorado River system is being threatened by all kinds of desecration, diversions, mostly by dams, manipulation of those streams. The Colorado, the main stem, and of course what it's made of is all the tributaries that come in. And those are being worked to death for human gain, for profit on the part of somebody or other. Every politician had his finger in the pie trying to satisfy his constituents' needs. His constituents put him in office, they pay the freight, so to speak, and he's going to respond to them, even though many of them were corporate constituents and those kinds who tend to destroy our Earth rather than help it.
Here's Charles Wilkinson.
As the 60s developed, after Arizona got its water right and was going to have the Central Arizona Project, which was going to bring water from the Colorado over to Phoenix and Tucson by means of a pipeline, Arizona was pushing hard for that. Well, Wayne Aspinall was chair of the House Interior Committee at that time. And Wayne Aspinall held a lock on all legislation. And he wasn't going to let the bill go through unless Colorado got its water projects. And Aspinall laid up five of them in this piece of legislation that was going to go through. And in fact, every one of the states in the watershed had projects they wanted. And it was a very delicate balance. But right at the heart of it was the Central Arizona Project. Water projects always have engineering obstacles, minor things like drilling under the Continental Divide, transporting water 200 miles from Mono Lake down to Los Angeles, etc. These are big projects. Well, the Central Arizona Project had the obstacle of distance, but it also had the obstacle of gradient. And a good part of that line from the Colorado River over to Phoenix and then to Tucson was uphill. In addition to pumping water a long distance, you had to pump it uphill. That wasn't going to stop anybody. When you've got a big-time Western development project in that era, nothing's going to stop it. The obstacle of gradient wasn't going to stop it. And in fact, the answer was simple. Dam the Grand Canyon. Plug the Grand Canyon, perfect for a reservoir. Build up a big head of water behind a couple of dams, and you've got hydropower to fuel the uphill climb of the Central Arizona Project. Oh, it was so simple.
One of Commissioner Floyd Dominey's greatest endeavors was to figure out how to supply water to the valleys of Central Arizona.
Now, the Bureau had been studying ways and means of supplying that water out of the Colorado River into Central Arizona, and we had determined that the water could be pumped out of Lake Havasu and carried across the country in line canals reaching Phoenix and Tucson. We, of course, we recognized that this was a very expensive project, and we had visualized a couple of hydroelectric dams below Grand Canyon Dam, one above the National Park and one below the National Park, Grand Canyon National Park, to be the cash register to underwrite the huge costs for this project.
Again, Charles Wilkinson.
By the 60s, however, simplicity wasn't as simple as it might have been a generation ago. The fly in the ointment, the ultimate pain in the ass, was David Brower. And Brower had this crazy idea that we shouldn't just dam the Grand Canyon, that it was a living canyon and a living river. It was immoral and bad economics and bad common sense and bad humanity to do that, and bad beauty. And Brower got up on his hind legs in the way that only he could, and he stopped the damming of the Grand Canyon.
Many years ago, I recorded a conversation with David Brower at his home in Berkeley, California. After he and the Sierra Club defeated the proposed Echo Park and Split Mountain dams on the Upper Green River, he was forced to address the so-called cash register dams intended to be built on either end of the Grand Canyon.
I became aware of the Grand Canyon Dam when I got interested in the Colorado River prior to the struggle over Dinosaur National Monument. We knew that the Bureau of Reclamation wanted to build some dams once the Arizona-California suit had been settled by the Supreme Court. There'd be some further development. We didn't know quite what it would be, but we did have proposals for the Grand Canyon dams, both of them. And in 1949, when I was on the Sierra Club Board of Directors, I voted for both dams. We found out later that there was a mistake to vote for those dams and that we'd been led down the Primrose Trail, that there would be enormous damage to the river itself and the life zones along the river, as well as the most beautiful part of the scenery and the living river. And the next year, we withdrew our support of that dam. Ever since then, I've been opposed to those dams and any other dams in the Colorado River, with my big slip when I was at least momentarily for not only Glen Canyon Dam, but a taller Glen Canyon Dam. That's a story I'd rather forget.
Here's Floyd Dominey.
This was the time when Admiral Rickover and Glenn Seaborg were making wild claims about atomic power and how cheap it was going to be. Seaborg was telling committees of Congress that the atomic power was going to be so cheap you wouldn't have to meter it. It's going to be so cheap you could desalt seawater and irrigate with it. So Congress was telling me, well, why do we need any more hydroelectric dams? Commissioner, you're passé. We're in the atomic age now. They were the ones that defeated the Bridge Canyon Dam. I had come to the conclusion that we could give up on marble. Marble was the lesser of the two as far as production of power. Well, the rest is history. Of course, we didn't get the authorization as proposed. The compromise to building Bridge Canyon Dam was to build a huge coal-fired plant, partly underwritten by the federal government, and the rest of it by the Salt River Project and other power users, power developers. So the pumping power to pump the water for the Central Arizona Project comes from this coal-fired plant. If you can visualize a plant that burns a trainload of coal a day, that's how big it is, 2.5 million kilowatt capacity. And the government's invested in that proposal in order to have power for the Central Arizona Project.
Again, David Brower.
So I kept learning. I first thought that you could save a lot of rivers by going to nuclear power. Then I found that was no good, so I was willing to save rivers by going to coal. And I found that was no good. And I finally smartened up and found out the way to save rivers and coal and avoid nuclear power is to take a whole new look at our ideas about economic growth and to ask the essential questions, what kinds of economic growth must we have and what kind can we and the earth no longer afford. And that's where my thinking has been ever since the Colorado Project.
Bruce Babbitt was Secretary of the Interior during the Clinton administration, and as watermaster of the lower Colorado River, inherited the legacy of controversy that continues to abound over allocation of water. I visited with him at his law offices in Washington, D.C., and he spoke of David Brower, Glen Canyon Dam, and Lake Powell.
I start thinking of Lake Powell by remembering David Brower. He was a great environmentalist, a great American, and he died with a very guilty conscience about Glen Canyon that dates back really to the fight over the dam at Dinosaur. The compromise was we'll move it downstream to Glen Canyon, and it was only later that David and others realized that it was a bigger sacrifice than the original site at Dinosaur, and that in fact, it really wasn't necessary to build a dam at either place. The logic for Glen Canyon Dam was embodied not on the land, but in a legal document, in the Colorado River Compact. It was driven by this kind of Talmudic discussion about shares and delivery requirements.
The 1922 Colorado River Compact actually set the stage for construction of the Glen Canyon Dam. Rick Gold is the deputy director of the Upper Colorado River region. When I visited him in Salt Lake City, he reiterated how the law of the river inevitably led to the presence of the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell.
What happens at Glen Canyon Dam is that it's there. It has about 25 million acre-feet in storage, and it allows the upper basin states of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico to utilize their Colorado River water supplies as allocated to them by the 22 Compact and among them in the 48 Compact. Without that storage, if that storage were not there, after a year or two of consecutive drought, like we're in today, you could see the lower basin with its priority call, seeking the release of upper basin water, and if it were not in storage to release, the only choice is to curtail upper basin development. So most of the cities in the upper basin, cities and farms, agriculture and industry that enjoy the benefits of just diverting water from the Colorado River or its tributaries would have to be cut back in order for the upper basin states to meet the downstream call at Lee Ferry. The compact is pretty specific in that it requires 75 million acre-feet in any 10-year period, or an average of about 7.5 million acre-feet, plus the shortfall in making up the Mexican depletion. So the target release of 8.23 million acre-feet every year at Lee Ferry would be very difficult to meet without a storage reservoir. So assuming that someone were seriously considering draining Lake Powell, that's the impact, is that you would be calling out states like Colorado and New Mexico from diverting their apportioned water supplies of the Colorado River because there would be no storage for the upper basin to meet its downstream requirement.
Charles Wilkinson has an interesting way of seeing how we value or fail to value water and how that factors into our overuse of the Colorado River.
Incredibly enough, even with the wild subsidies of the Hard Rock Mining Act, you still have to pay a minimal fee to get a patent to a mining claim. But water is free, and you may have to transport it, and you may have to build a large canal from the Colorado River over to Los Angeles or a pipeline from the Colorado River over to Phoenix and Tucson, but the water itself is free. We have this high-sounding language about water, but we've never lived up to it, and what we've really done is just opened the rivers for a very competitive race between individuals and between states. First in time, first in right, and you can take all you want. You can dry rivers up. Of course, the main river itself in most years when it hits the Gulf of California is dry. And so we've given no heed to the rivers as rivers. And we've given no heed to the value of water, in fact. We've given it away on the cheap.
By the 1970s, the environmental movement had gained a foothold in American culture. It was during this time that both the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act were passed by Congress. These acts confronted our society with the effect of continuous development without considering probable consequences. They forced us to examine the effects of resource extraction and development on the natural environment and the possible jeopardy to the species with whom we share our habitat. Attorney Pam Hyde is the Executive Director for Policy for Southwest Rivers and is part of a growing movement to decommission the Glen Canyon Dam and drain Lake Powell. I visited with her in Flagstaff, and she described the horns of the dilemma.
The difficulty now is that we're going back and saying that the way that the law is set up continues to allow for consumptive uses, diversions out of the river, without any real recognition of what the environmental consequences of those actions are. And the only thing that we have to work with now to try and reset that balance are the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act. And it's a real question mark still as to which laws prevail. I mean, if you're putting the Endangered Species Act up against, say, the Colorado River Storage Project Act, does water development prevail or endangered species protection prevail? And it's just not clear still. And one of the fears of the environmental community is if you actually ask that question, you might not get the answer that you want, and then you have nothing left to try and push for environmental protection.
Katie Lee is well known throughout the West as a folk musician, author, and outspoken opponent of the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell. I visited with Katie at her home in central Arizona. She reminisced about the wonderful time she spent running the Colorado River through Glen Canyon, and she sang for me The Cry of the Wild River.
Last night I lay in a restless bed, a humdrum life pounding in my head. Went out of the night.
My years in the Glen Canyon were from 1954 till 1962. Three of those years were spent with wonderful friends, Tad Nichols, photographer from Tucson, and Frank Wright, owner of Mexican Hat Expeditions. And these two people and I went on trips in the fall when there was nobody on the river, really. October and September, we'd be down there 2 and 3 weeks at a time with our cameras and our feet. And we explored canyons that had never been explored before. We put names on these canyons to identify them for ourselves. And then later, they became the names of those canyons. They had Indian names, I'm sure, long before we ever showed up. Once in a while, we saw some cattle. One time. Nothing else. Nothing but wild animals, birds, fish. The canyon ran forever. We listened to the canyon, and boy, those canyons talked to us.
The Colorado River in the West is a production of the Arizona Humanities Council, Executive Director Dan Schilling. Our series is sponsored by the Humanities Councils and Endowments of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Ford Foundation. The project director is Nancy Dallette. The executive producer is Marcos Martinez. Our production assistant is Celestia Peregrina Leffler. Our theme music was performed by Carl Bernstein. The series was produced in its entirety by Jack Leffler in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For the Colorado River and the West, thank you for listening.
My heart knows what the river knows. I got to go where the river goes. Restless river, wild and free. The lonely ones are you and me. Someday, before I'm old and gray, I'll find a woman who'll go my way. She'll take the rapids strong with me, and she'll blend her voice in a song with me. My heart knows what the river knows. I gotta go where that river goes. Restless river, so wild and free. The lonely ones are you.